Session number 14978, Charles Turnbull, Reel 8.
Mr. Turnbull, Reel 8. You got on board the corvette. How many more got on with you? Was it packed?
It was. We were on the deck, and it was pretty full. And when we got back, we landed in Plymouth. That was where we were taken to.
The journey itself, was it incident
free? Smooth, incident free. We weren't attacked at all.
When you got to Plymouth, what was the reception?
Well, the reception was excellent. People were waiting for you to come off, and you were sort of given refreshment, you know, mugs of tea and sandwiches, and, you know, the population were pleased to see you back, and you weren't accepted as a, should I say, a defeated force. People didn't react that way, although it must have been a shock to see people coming back the way they had to come back, but it wasn't regarded as a defeat.
Was that reflected throughout the country over the next few days, this, where you came into contact, that you weren't defeated? Which is rather remarkable.
I would say yes. They just accepted that they'd been beaten by a superior force who'd been better equipped for the job. I would say that they had, should we say, better military brains, and they had being more organised as a fighting force than what we were, and the troops couldn't be blamed for what they had to suffer and what they had gone through. And I would say, really, I think the reaction was a little bit that really we'd been let down a little bit by our allies. That really who we had regarded as a large and a good fighting force, and they'd had years and years where they'd been in the Maginot Line, and what had happened when the German forces had outflanked the line, and the way the Belgian army and the Dutch forces, the way they had been sort of cut through in quick time, that really the British force, as far as the English people was concerned, had done what they had to do, and had fought as admirably as what they could.
What condition were you in by now? It's been pretty untidy and dirty and what have you.
Well, we were a little bit dishevelled, but we still maintained our correct uniform. Should I say that we were tired and a little worn out, and but after getting back to England, well, we were soon uplifted by the reaction of the population. And one thing that did cheer me up was when we landed at Plymouth, with getting got back the way that we had, we found out that we were only the three Durhams that were there, that the the rest of the Durhams that had managed to get away from the beach and they must have got away quicker than what we did, because they had been assembled in Norfolk, and my parents in Durham had received notification from the War Office that I was reported missing. Anyhow, after 3 or 4 days, I think we went from Plymouth up to Okehampton, and from there I sent a telegram, of course, to say that I'd arrived safely, which was great news because they'd already received this telegram reporting me missing, so that was good news back in Durham.
What happened to you at Okehampton?
Well, what happened initially was that we received a 7-day pass to go back home, more or less immediately.
Had you rejoined the battalion there?
Was it not really? No.
It was just an assembly camp.
It was really. But it was rather funny. Eventually, I don't know why, but the Durhams, when it came to reassembly as a unit again, we did get back to Okehampton. And that was where really the 10th Battalion was reassembled again, not in Norfolk. It must have just been in Norfolk, it must have just been a case of a camp whereby to get people together again and find out who had got back and sort them out.
So you weren't in Okehampton long after you'd arrived, you weren't there long?
No, but we got the order after the 7-day bus to go back there.
So when you went home on leave, your telegram must be just ahead of you to say you were safe.
That's right.
How did your family receive you?
Well, they were delighted, of course.
Did they expect
to see us back?
Did they know you were coming?
Well, we'd sent word that we were coming on leave.
And again, the attitude of family and friends and in the neighbourhood was not one of that could be described as defeatist.
But that wasn't in anybody's minds. They just really thought that we'd really assemble again and the fight back would come.
How were you received by friends then? In your hometown?
Well, everybody was pleased to see you back and find out how you got on, but I always say that really it was a thing that you didn't talk about. And really, apart from now, I must admit that it's a thing that I just pushed out of my mind.
Were there many young men around in civilian clothing which made you feel in any way upset that they was not in the army yet?
I would say that really that reaction didn't come into things, that you knew that the young people who had been left, they really had an important job to do, like my brother who was serving on the railway, and the mines had to be kept going, you know, that people had been recruited, young men, to go into the mines as Bevan boys and things like that. And you didn't bear any malice or anything like the thing that they were at home and you were away. That thought never came into my mind.
After 7 days, and you went back to
Okehampton.
And the battalion.
And the battalion was assembled there again. And that was really when I, after we'd been assembled there for a short while, the people who had been in France were the nucleus of the new battalion. And as recruits came in, well, that was where I got my first stripe, you know, and I think it was through the experience abroad that you became a Lance Corporal.
What date would this be?
Well, that would be really in the June, wouldn't it? June. Middle of June, I would say.
What did it mean, this first stripe? In terms of pay and responsibilities?
I was quite pleased to think that I had been recognised as someone capable of carrying a stripe. I don't think the increase in pay was very much. It was the idea of in life you try to achieve an object, and as I said when I joined up, that really I would make the best of life in the forces, and I thought that really a stripe was an acknowledgement that really you were someone capable of assuming responsibility.
Had your friends, your two friends with you, had they been promoted?
No, they went back to batman's duties.
So your relationship with them was not changed by the fact that you had a stripe and they were private?
It made no change at all. But it meant from then on that really I was more concerned with duties within the company. But really we had a section and a platoon and really became associated more with lieutenants in charge of the platoon and that sort of thing. Although you never lost your respect for your company commander, but it was a different life altogether. That you knew then, after the duties as a company clerk and what had happened in France, well, as a lance corporal, you had to get on with thinking more about what happened as a, should we say, a fighting unit.
Which company were you in?
That time I was in D Company, I think it was.
And you remember the platoon number?
Can't remember.
So now you're in effect a section corporal or lance corporal.
Lance corporal.
How was a platoon split? What was the organisation of a platoon?
Well, in the platoon at that time, there again, it was a case of, if I remember rightly, really re-equipment. That really what had been lost had to be, it was a reformation. And initially it was really rifle training, still bayonet practice, new recruits had come in, how to drill, again, route marshes. And should we say, I think the idea of what had happened in France then, there was a more training with tactical formations and things like that on how to take cover and outflank dispositions, not sort of head-to-head combat and frontal combat on more... a mobile atmosphere had come into the picture.
Just basically fire and movement.
Fire and movement.
How many sections in a platoon?
In a platoon there was four sections. A, B, C and D.
And you as a lance corporal, did you command a section?
You were in charge of a section.
How many men
under
would that be?
Under your platoon commander.
How many men would that be?
Normally... about seven or eight.
Do you remember your platoon commander at that time?
The platoon commander that I can remember vividly was a Lieutenant Brutnall. I can remember other platoon commanders quite vividly. Lieutenant Delaney. But Brutnall was the one I can remember quite vividly as a sort of a platoon leader.
Did you get on well with him?
Very well. I got on well with all the officers.
So he was platoon commander. Who was the next in line, in the line of, or chain of command in a platoon? Was it a platoon sergeant or something?
Well, we had a platoon sergeant.
Who was that, do you recall?
Don't think it was Sergeant Pratt. No, I wouldn't like to commit myself to that person then.
Lieutenant, platoon sergeant?
Corporal, platoon corporal.
And the four sections and their leaders. And you were responsible for your section, there was your little group.
Section commander.
What were your duties as a section commander?
Ensuring that they were well turned out, well looked after, ensuring that discipline was maintained within the section, and that really the object being that you became the best section in the platoon.
And in an action situation, you would be given tasks which
tasks.
Meant that you led those men.
That's right. You were the leader. One who had to be looked up to, and that was your object, that you were the person who they respected, and what orders was given by you would be efficiently carried out. And I would say that I maintained that discipline through, apart from duty hours, during off-duty hours, still playing with the men as far as possible, and falling in with whatever they wanted to do within reason. And I found out that through adopting that attitude, you're more looked up to, and your orders during duty hours were fulfilled at all times.
You'd come back from France, as you say, pretty well shattered, and what little equipment you had even less now. New people coming in. Was equipment and weapons coming through, but how quickly were you getting them?
They were coming through slowly. That you found out that eventually Bren guns and mortars were starting to come into the unit, which meant that you had to have sessions on the Bren gun, on training with that sort of thing, and you had instructors who were training formations on how to use the Bren gun, which made one feel as though we were becoming better equipped. And as far as mobile things were concerned, you were starting to become equipped with carriers. They were commencing to form carrier platoons.
Were all the men in the section riflemen? They had no other weapon in the section?
Not at that time, but Bren guns were becoming to be allocated, and one could say that that would be one of the main weapons within the companies.
Did you like the Bren?
Very good. Good weapon.
Any problems with it at all? Did it have any difficulties?
No difficulties, really. It was a very good and efficient weapon. And one felt that really, if we had been, you know, better equipped with that automatic weapon in France, probably the situation might have been better restored than what it eventually became.
So you have four sections into a platoon, and you've got your platoon leader. Who was company commander at this time? D Company, I think you said you were
still Peter Stock.
You still had him?
Still had him.
And the battalion commander, was that still the same?
Still Marley.
What were the immediate important things that you had to be doing with this battalion that was newly formed, basically?
Well, it became that really we had exercises where the battalion had to become part of the brigade and training was in that sort of objective. It really had platoon training, company training, battalion training, and then on to a brigade level.
What was Okehampton Camp like?
Tented camp outside, and then eventually after that we went to Carmarthen.
How long was Okehampton?
Probably about a couple of months.
And then on to Carmarthen, what were you doing there?
Similar sort of thing again. It was this time not a tented camp. It was a Nissen hooded camp.
Better conditions?
Better conditions.
And the training, did that take on any new facet at all? You're doing anything different from what you've done at Okehampton? Carmarthen's quite hilly area, isn't it?
It is. But we're mainly in Wales. Most of the time we're in England, different parts of Wales. And when I mentioned Carmarthen, I'm not absolutely certain whether we weren't at Carmarthen after we came back from Iceland or that was before. Because we weren't in Wales very, very long before we got the order that really we would be receiving embarkation leave again, which was quite a surprise. Because initially we'd been told that after our experiences in France, it would be a long while before we'd be sent abroad again.
So what date are we talking about now when this information came through?
Well, we embarked for Iceland in the September.
Of 1940.
I can remember hearing word would be in the August that we would be, back end of August, we would be receiving embarkation leave, which just appeared on the notice board. In fact, I can remember at that time we were near Pontypool. And when we received this order, we were a bit nonplussed because we still didn't feel ready to go abroad again. We still didn't think we were trained enough, that the period hadn't been long enough. And there again, the three lads that we used to go out together, and we went down to a local pub and we said, what are we going to do now? If we go abroad again, it could be anywhere. It could be the Far East. And we weren't very happy about the idea because we had sort of resumed part of our civilian life and we hadn't really had time to settle down again. So I said, well, I know what I'm going to do. That when I joined up, I had been engaged to a young lady, Nancy Bainbridge, who lived in Easington Lane. And at that time, when I left Durham, she had gone to Blackpool to be bridesmaid to a young lady there. And when she was there, she said, and this young lady's mother had a boarding house there. And she said, well, Nancy, why go back to Durham when Charlie's gone? You might as well stay here. And during the war years, you can work in Blackpool. So Nancy said, well, I'll do that. So I said, well, I know what I'm going to do. I'm not going to go abroad again without having another leave. And I'm going to send a telegram off to Blackpool and say to Nancy, make arrangements to get married. So the next morning, I asked for an interview with the CEO, and I asked for compassionate leave. And I was given a 4-day pass. So after sending the telegram off, I went to Blackpool. That was a Monday morning, and I had to be back on there Thursday evening. So Nancy had received this telegram during an air raid in Blackpool, and she'd been under the stairs when this telegram had been handed to her, and it said, make arrangements to get married. Why, by the time she could make the arrangements, she couldn't make arrangements till the Thursday morning. And I was married on the Thursday morning, and of course I had to leave to get back to camp on the Thursday night. So we were married by in a registry office, and the name of the man who married us was John Arthur Jump. And my father had come from Durham. He was there. And Nancy's friend and our brother were the bridesmaid and best man. And I left Blackpool Station at 11 o'clock on the Thursday evening, and back to camp down in South Wales. And when I arrived back there, the lads had my kit bag packed and were ready to go to the station. And off we went to the station, and funny enough, I think it was Carmarthen. And we got on a train and went up to the north of Scotland.
Just before we come to that, how did you get to get permission from the commander to marry at that time?
I received permission from the commanding officer.
That was the usual routine?
Yes. And you had to explain why you wanted compassionate leave.
So when you did you know that at this stage, did you know where you were going?
We had no idea at all where we were going. We still had our normal equipment. We arrived after disembarking from the train, and we had to board this transport, still with our ordinary uniform. And we got onto this boat, which was a flat-bottom boat. No idea where we were going. And when we were so far out, we were issued with, eventually, Arctic clothing, which was a bit non-plussing. Wondered, where on earth are we going with Arctic clothing? And eventually, the destination was Iceland.
What clothing were you issued with? What kind of clothing was this?
Warm clothing, and after we'd heard it was Iceland, we had the idea why we'd be given this warmer type clothing, which was leather jerkins, etc.
Was there sheep's wool or that kind of clothing, woolen clothing?
It was more, well, you know what a leather jerkin's like. But warmer clothing to go on top of your ordinary uniform. And when we heard about going to Iceland, we learned from really our officers that the reason was that information had been given that the German forces may attempt to make a landing in Iceland so they could use that as a base to threaten the shipping crossing the Atlantic that they could give them a better chance to use it as a base to stop the convoys, etc., carrying weapons, equipment and food from America to England.
So in the situation again of a partly trained unit going into a situation where, as far as you knew, you may well be facing the Germans yet again.
Similar to what it was when we went in 1940.
Did this affect your morale at all, thinking, oh, here we go again?
Well, it was a case of here we go again, but we were slightly better equipped than what we were before we went to France. In a way, a little better trained. And when we got to Iceland, we were split up into small units to outlying parts of the Iceland where companies were detailed off armed sections to guard vulnerable parts of the island.